The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 22nd of May, 2020. On the podcast today, Cahill Friel, Executive Chairman of Open Orphan. And Cahill describes what the proceeds of their £12 million fundraise will be used for. Also on the podcast, Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell, discusses the slew of companies conducting equity fundraisers and if it's possible to accurately value a company at the moment. Also, I have Paul Hill, full-time investor and equity analyst, gives his view on the market and mentions the following companies: Lloyds, Elicosoft, Northbridge, Aviva, Clearstar, and Accesso Technology. And as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see both these lists, top 10 versions of these lists actually, at voxmarkets.co.uk. We can also check out our COVID-19 index. These are companies well-placed to trade through this pandemic, or it may even benefit from the change in trend that we've seen during this coronavirus outbreak. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Want to get live push notification alerts whenever a company you follow releases an RNS? Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Cahill Friel, Executive Chairman of Open Orphan, ORPH ticker there. Cahill, thanks for joining me.
Justin, good morning. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. And you're off the back of raising a decent chunk of change there, 12 million proposed fundraising today. So we'll ask what that's going to be used for. But as always, Cahill, I don't like to leave people behind. So if they've never heard of you, could you just summarise what Open Orphan is about, please?
Absolutely, Justin. Look, Open Orphan is a rapidly growing. We put two small struggling companies together, Venn Life Science, hVIVO, and today we're now the world leader in the testing of vaccines and antivirals using a trial called Human Challenge Study Model. We're based in East London, and we've got very exciting plans ahead. So,
Excellent stuff. Okay, so this 12 million, like I said, a decent amount of money is some also being subscribed on primary bid for private investors. Now, you'll get some people, private investors, saying you've done a discount here, big discount, 26%. What's the deal?
Yeah, well, Justin, good point. We started this roadshow Friday morning of last week, 7 days ago, and we started, the share price was 11p. So as you know, institutions, and it was targeted, will not come in at a price higher than when you start the roadshow. Okay. Yes, share price spiked up the last couple of days, and as I think the public may know, I've been busy talking it down because I didn't want it to go wild until we got the fundraising out of the way. So look, we've got five times, we set out to raise 5 million. We got orders from absolute household name blue chip companies who in the past might never have even taken a meeting from me, and now they're piling in. That should give great security to our great retail following. We have a fabulous retail following, but I think building up the balance sheet with a lot of solid institutions who'll stick there and stay there should be a great comfort.
Yeah, okay, so that's good news there. And let's go straight to, what essentially, I mean, you've also mentioned in here antibody tests, and take us through that, because it's a minefield. There's lots of this going on. It's a very competitive field. You know, the government talk about it every day, and it's a game changer, knowing who's had it, who's got immunity, and you've got these ones now. I saw even Superdrug, 69 quid, I think. You can buy one online. What's the deal with yours compared to others, and where we stand with this?
Yeah, look, we deliberately mentioned our antibody test and what quotient is transformational, and we didn't use that word lightly. The reason it's transformational for us is there's only 3 testing kits in the world that give 100% accuracy. That's quotient, the Roche deal, it was all over the UK press last week, and Abbott. And the reason they're 100%, you have to go to your GP, they're full blood draws. There is lots of home kits, they're much cheaper, they're fingerprint kits. Won't mention any of their names, but we all know, unless it's a full blood draw, they cannot give 100% accuracy. For antibody testing, we're targeting employers who want to ensure their staff have or have not, and as such, it's a completely different market, and we still can't believe we are Quotient's sole UK distributor. A machine arrived in, it can do 3,000 tests a day. We'll be going through the channel partners, GP networks, big employers, the Tesco's, the Sainsbury's, the big financial services players such as JP Morgan, Citibank, and the City of London. So we're going to deal directly with channel partners such as that. We won't be dealing with people directly in their homes.
Yeah, yeah. And when do you hope to start rolling this out then, Kyle?
Monday week, we're open for business. The machine arrived, was air freighted in Monday of last week. It's up and running. We're doing trial tests all of this week. We're perfecting it next week, and we're open literally for blood Monday week.
Marvellous stuff. Okay. And talking about you're developing this challenge model, just explain what it is and why and the potential, if you could.
Yeah, look, this is, we have two transformational things. Early March, we say we're going to develop a coronavirus challenge study model, and we say we're going to co-develop it maybe with some overseas Chinese partners. We got overwhelmed with inquiries from vaccine companies around the world, and we decided to scale up really fast. And instead, we're going to self-fund. It'll cost us about $3 million to develop the two COVID-19 challenge study models. But by doing that and funding it ourselves, that's what kicked off our fundraising initiative, is that we can deal, at the moment, we have most of the leading COVID-19 vaccine manufacturers contacting us, saying, when can you do a trial? This way, we can sell those trials to 10, 12 companies at potentially $7 million per trial. And if we do it ourselves, we can do it, supply it to all of them. And the really good part is for the staff, employees, and ourselves, we can, for the first time in our life, impact humanity. If we make our challenge study model available to every vaccine manufacturer in the world at a price, at a cost, we can speed up the delivery of a COVID-19 solution.
Yeah. So obviously a huge potential there. But what's your thoughts? I mean, a lot of people are saying now that, I mean, obviously everyone's jumping into this COVID-19 space. It's very hot. But some people are saying that more people have had it than we think. We could even get to sort of close to herd immunity before a vaccine comes out. What's your thoughts?
Look, I don't know. I'm no expert, other than I have a lot of experts working for us. Look, I think the general view is no, herd immunity is going to be a long time away, because the shutdowns across Europe and in Britain have been very successful. Mm. It has stopped the spread. And I think you've seen some numbers this week at the population across Europe, not just Britain, might still have between 5 and 10% immunity. That's a long way from herd. Herd has been 50 or 60. Mm. But I think, look, the reality is, there's 100 COVID-19 vaccines in development. There's 20 real ones. Our friends in Oxford, the Moderna one, the J&J one, they're all public. There's 20 real ones. Of those 20 real ones, more than half are in discussions with us. But the reality is, there's going to be a couple of successful North American ones, a couple of successful European ones, a couple of successful Asian and Chinese ones. There's no one winner takes all. This is going to be a long process. There's going to be a lot of vaccines coming. It's not going to be like the movie where everybody gets a sugar lump in the mouth and it's game over. It's going to become dealable. Life is going to start returning to a new normal. And there's going to be a lot of solutions. There's going to be a lot and variety of vaccines, and people have an option which one they want to take. That's our belief how it's going to roll out.
Yeah. I mean, one thing for sure, we have to get the economy back open, and these antibody testings are essential for that, aren't they, you know?
Absolutely. Look, I think from an employer's perspective, if you the interesting part, we've all been locked down, the whole world, but actually the whole world has managed to work pretty well in lockdown and keep business going. But the reality is 50% of people who get COVID-19 have absolutely no symptoms and no knowledge they had it. One benefit of getting COVID-19, you're immune for at least a year, two, three. We know you don't get immunity for life. The difference is, have you immunity 1 year or 5 years? We don't know. It looks more like 3, 4, 5 years. That means if you've had it, you go back to work. That's for antibody tests for employers. But look, the reality is, I think, Justin, look, I think this is going to become more manageable. Governments had to do the scare thing, scare people into the caves, get them off the roads, get them into the homes to slow down the virus. Governments around the world are now going to have to stop the scare tactics and be nice to people and encourage them out and say, well, look, folks, we can deal with this. It's the new normal. Protect the vulnerable, i.e. the very elderly. And if you think sub-16-year-olds have immunity, it doesn't seem to affect them. And the rest of us will slowly but surely, I think, get back to life as a new normal, not perfectly normal. And there will be a ton of vaccines coming down the road. We know that. We're talking to most of them. And some of them will be more successful than others. But I think there was a scare tactic taken, get us all off the streets. Now the government's going to have to be a little bit of a carrot, bring us back out again and get the new normal moving again.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Kyle, as always, three reasons here. If someone likes the sound of what you're talking about, you hear, but not yet following the story, give them those three reasons why they should hit that follow button and add you to their watch list, please.
Very good. Well, I think I've constantly said that Open Orphan has big plans, big designs, and we've backed it with our own money. We're probably the most invested management team in any company. We're approaching 100 million market cap today, but we think we can drive it a lot more. We've got three big revenue areas: challenge study models, huge growing market, antibodies models, and lab testing. So I think at the moment, we now actually have a fundraising that was 5 times oversubscribed, and that by institutions. So that should give everybody comfort. We now have a great, stable, both fabulous retail following, but believe it or not, a fabulous institutional following as of this morning. So hopefully that gives people something to think about and ponder.
Marvellous stuff, Kyle. Good to chat to you. Hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Justin, a pleasure, and thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell. You all right, Russ?
I'm in good health, I'm pleased to say, Justin. I hope you are too.
Yes. Well, do you know what? I've just listened to a sort of, I think it was a BBC podcast, there's Business Matters or something, and we're talking about the... you know, the amount of people being laid off in America and how many of those will actually stick and how many will bounce.
39 million.
That's, of course, a gross figure, initial jobless claims. So we don't know. Of course, there's hirings as well, apparently. Amazon are hiring all these people. So we don't know. But they're saying even if, you know, majority go back to work, it's still going to be a massive amount of people unemployed. And like I said, at the moment, that 38 million is what, is a quarter of the workforce, which shows you the hit. Now, we don't know what's, like I said, apparently at the moment, we don't know. We haven't had the financial fallout. We haven't had the companies reporting from Q2. We know it's going to be bad. But until, you know, you're a guy who runs figures, you've got spreadsheets, you know, what do you do? I mean, there's so many companies at the moment just saying, we're not giving any guidance because we have no idea. So no one has any idea. So what do you do?
I think as an investor, therefore, you do what the companies are doing, which is sit on your, well, companies are not sitting on your other hands, but in terms of trying to second guess, companies aren't doing it. And if they can't do it, then I can assure you as an investor, it's the absolute devil's work for you. Mm. So what I would be doing is I would be running my spreadsheets over cash flows as best I can. And to be fair, lots of companies have been increasingly clear over their rate of cash burn, which I think is an incredibly helpful. I'm sure it's a bit of an estimate because, again, nobody's perfect. But, you know, Whitbread, for example, very clear. Our cash burn, I think they've quoted the figure at £80 million a month.
Yeah.
So you could work out straight away if things stay exactly as they are, i.e. all of their hotels and pubs and restaurants are shut, they've got 18 months for the cash.
Yeah.
You knew exactly where you were. And you could then take a rational view. Do I think that we're still going to be in the same very difficult position in 18 months' time or not? You've got a stock that's trading at basically book value, give or take, which to me seems like a reasonable starting premise. And if you're pretty confident that Whitbread and Premier Inn will still be around in 18 months' time, you know that Travelodge, one of its biggest rivals, is frankly in a bit of financial shtuck, and actually Whitbread could come out of this even stronger, you might think, okay, I've got a little bit of visibility here. And that's the sort of numbers that you're looking for companies to give. Now, having said that, Whitbread then surprised everybody by saying, actually, we quite fancy having a rights issue to raise £1 billion, which, you know, the shares initially stumbled, but they are still trading above the theoretical ex rights price, which would suggest that investors are thinking, actually, you know what? Belt and braces, an extra £1 billion. That means they've got another 12 months on top. That's 2.5 years of cash burn with no customers coming through the door. That gives us extra visibility and the down protection on the downside. And if we come out of it before then, they've got some ready cash to go around and get stuck into their German expansion strategy and maybe take advantage if any of their UK rivals don't make it to the other side. And some have got an awful lot of debt. Now, Whitbread has virtually no debt, but it does have £2.5 billion of leases on its balance sheet, which don't look to be desperately flexible. So in that respect, it does have liabilities that it needs to deal with. So what you need to be doing as an investor is looking at cash burn. Now, some companies it's easier to work out than others, but they'll all have an idea, and I think that's where you're coming at right now, because in the end, the cash just doesn't lie. And at the moment, I still think, you know, I know you and I have been a bit windy for a little bit. We've both been very pleasantly surprised by the rally, I suspect. I know I certainly have. But it just doesn't make me... I know markets are forward-looking, and I know they're smart, and they're certainly smarter than I am. But as you said, when you've got American unemployment at the highest level since the Great Depression in the 1930s, it doesn't make me comfortable when equity valuations are within 5 or 10% of their all-time highs.
Mm-hmm. Well, if that's the thing I've been discussing or thinking about a lot, is looking at indices as opposed to stocks? Because, like I say, it's a stock market, yes, but it's a market of stocks. Now,
stocks.
If you look at Whitbread, for example, you can say, okay, they've got what do you say, 18 months worth of cash now, whatever.
Correct. It'll be two and a half years by the time they finish if the investors stump up. Yeah.
Yeah, but even then, there's an added complication of what level will they get back to? Say in 2 years' time, will they be at 100% as they were in trading just before this happened?
I'm completely with you.
Yeah, and then because at the moment you say okay, but 48 quid they were at their share price before this, in 20th of Feb. They're now down to 24 quid, which is half. So that's suggesting that basically they've lost half their things. But then, of course, it's a gradual. You may only get sort of 5% people booking, and then that'll gradually build over the next 2 years. So you probably think, hang on a second, are they going to lose? It's hard to know, is it? Because it's forward guidance.
So
they've lost half their value. Are they going to lose half their profit from this year, maybe? Of course, the costs on top, and maybe a bit of interest payments and all that stuff. Maybe they will, but it's hard to judge, isn't it?
It's incredibly. And I think, therefore, I wouldn't do too much second guessing. I think I would try and look for those companies that have got, relatively safe balance sheets. And I think Whitbread will be one of the relatively safer ones out there. I'd still be wary of companies that have got lots of debt and a lot of high operational gearing. Equally, you may look at some of these placings and rights issues, and they're coming thick and fast. I think there's another six today, placings or rights issues or open offers. And you may take the view that, like Whitbread, a chance to take part in the rights issue at 15 quid a share and clamber aboard, you might think, actually, again, that's giving you a little bit of extra downside protection. But that's what I'd be doing. I just wouldn't be getting too carried away because, as you say, we just don't know. I mean, we've got a bad idea about Q2, but we don't know how long it's going to last. And I think markets are still of the view, looking at consensus estimates for 2020 on the FTSE, there's a pretty big bounce in earnings and dividends penciled in analysts right now. They might be right, but they're not guaranteed to be. And investing isn't about knowing the future. None of us can do that. We all have opinions, but none of us know. Again, what we're doing is assessing the balance of probabilities. And I think the market has gone from pricing in a monumentally deep and long recession in late March to actually a really rapid bounce back is what it's now expecting. I suspect the truth probably lies somewhere between the two. And although our natural temptation is to go looking for things to buy, at the minute, after the monster rally we've had, that contrasts so markedly with the grisly economic data that we've got and have yet to come, I know it's tempting to try and look through it, and markets are trying to look through it, but a lot of it is fueled by central bank cash, and I think that is a fairly brittle foundation. I think the long run, central banks will win because they can just keep on printing. I mean, there may be deleterious consequences of that, and you probably won't. If you think that's going to be the case, then that's why your gold mining shares are running quite nicely right now. Thank you very much. I think they will win, but I think in the short term, it could be ugly. And don't forget, in 2000 to 2003, in 2007 to 2009, markets still went down when central banks were slashing interest rates and throwing money at it. And the Bank of England's clearly getting windy because it's talking about the dreadful prospect of negative interest rates now. Yeah. So they are clearly, and the government is talking about the mortgage holiday payment extended to October, furlough scheme extended to September, October. They are not clearly expecting a rapid uptick in economic activity. Now, it might happen and we might be pleasantly surprised, but prepare for the worst and hope for the best. And I think at the moment, markets are maybe not quite preparing for the worst. I think they've switched very quickly to hoping for the best, which just opens you up to a bit more downside risk.
Yeah, I know. It's when you go look at the indices, you got, for example, at NASDAQ, you have a lot of big tech companies that are doing quite well at the moment anyway. So, and I think they hold about 12 to 15% of the weighting in the NASDAQ, those big companies there. So
yeah,
the FANG
companies.
Yeah.
And now we're up about 18% of the S&P 500.
Wow.
Those five names. Yeah. They're bigger than the FTSE 100. I mean, it's just, it is amazing. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying it's amazing.
Yeah.
And if you chuck in Microsoft, then you're at 24, 25% of the S&P 500 in six stocks.
Wow. Yeah. So you can see why they've done well there compared to the market. And say, it's just the vibe between Wall Street and Main Street. One thing I've noticed is these raising that's going on, the constant companies trying to get raises away, or they are doing it. And to me, that says, why do you think they're doing that? It just says a lot, doesn't it? That they are battening down the hatches. The financial fallout hasn't happened yet, I don't believe. And I think when we started to get, I know we're expecting a lot of bad news in from Q2, which we'll be reporting in Q3, of course. But when we get that, I just think it'll be an overwhelming amount of bad news coming out. In the end, the market will sort of give way, you know?
Well, that's what happened in 00 to 03 and 07 to 09. Eventually, they just got biffed in the face so often. They did just go to the canvas. And then the sort of central bank oxygen, as it were, was rushed over in even bigger quantities. I mean, AJ Bell shells will be delighted I'm not running the company. But, you know, or any company for that matter. But if I was running a quoted company and I felt I needed money, I would look to go early and I would look to go big.
Yeah.
Because, you know, at the moment, you know, in the end, ultimately, with rights issues, familiarity will breed contempt. Mm. The discounts will have to get bigger. Investors will become more sceptical. There might even be a little bit more, little bit less cash knocking around. And so if you are going to go as a company, I would be inclined to go. And again, doing these deals over the summer is normally a little bit harder than it is over the spring. Equally, doesn't feel like we're all going to be necessarily dashing off to the beach too much this year. So that might change a little bit. But if I was going to go, yeah, I'd be going now. I'd be doing what Whitbread have done and Informa have done, and Carnivals didn't quite go so smoothly. But you know, Whitbread and Informa have both gone big and early, and I think there'll be more companies looking at that thing. They'll be looking at how those deals go. Informa's flew, Whitbread they put the prospectus out. It's a rights issue, not a placing, and they'll be looking at what investor response they get. If it goes well and the take up is high, and the syndicate isn't left wearing the stock, then I think there'll be a lot more people tempted to do the same thing. And again, as investors, you know, if it's a rights issue, then you then have a decision to take. Do I support it or do I not? And if you don't, then you get diluted down, which is, you know, and dilution is the enemy, one of the biggest enemies of the investor, because it lessens your percentage ownership of the company and lessens your percentage claim on its cash flow and therefore the dividends that it pays. And you want to avoid that if you can. So yeah, avoid, but step one, if you possibly can, avoid companies that need money full stop. But in this environment, who knows? But I think, you know, if you do own one that needs money, then try and make sure you've got a bit of cash in the kitty, because then you can avoid the dilution and maybe get in an advantageous price.
Yeah, yeah. And do you know what? You're right. This time right now on this bounce where we're at, I think if you look at the NASDAQ, it's just the high, it's just above the previous high, and that often proves resistance. When you get a lower high, it's not a good sign.
Yeah,
and
no,
so
it's
if
not.
We start rolling over now, it's going to get harder to raise money. So now is a
Correct.
Good time. If you've got it away now, it's a good time to do it, because batten on the hatches now and see what happens. But as far just, as the private investor is concerned, I suppose now, it's, you know, have patience, isn't it? I mean, you know, the companies are taking on cash. Why didn't you take on cash? Get some cash on your portfolio and wait, see what happens, you know?
I would definitely be risk stressing my portfolio. Anything I bought for a bit of a punt, for a bit of a dob about, I think, you know, that I would still be stress testing. And I think you want to be, you know, making sure that you've got confidence in your company's your holdings finances. Stress where the weak point, have a look where the weak points are. You know, dividend cuts have obviously been fiendishly difficult to avoid, and I'm 46 FTSE 100 companies. United Utilities this morning is saying it's keeping an eye on its cash flow because it's worried about customer bad payments. And so if the utilities are starting to look, you know, I mean, Severn Trent seemed a bit more confident to me yesterday, but even they flagged 20-odd million pounds of bad debt provisions because, you know, those who've been unlucky enough to lose their job or be furloughed are obviously finding it harder to pay. So if the utilities aren't completely convinced about life, then it's pretty tricky for most people, right? So I think, again, you need to look at anything that's offering you a double-digit dividend yield. I think, you know, you really need to have a cold look at yourself and think, how realistic is that when the Bank of England's about to turn interest rates negative?
Yeah.
And then I would be looking at which companies you think might need money, and have I got enough? Can I avoid any dilution? And that's what I'd be doing. I wouldn't really necessarily, after a monster run, be looking to overreach myself and start piling on fresh risk right now. When I know you've got the push and the pull between bad data on one hand, central banks on the other. And again, I think central banks will win because I almost think they can't afford to lose.
No, they can't.
Because they've got so many people through QE gone up the risk curve into stocks and junk bonds. They're kind of a little bit stuck and they almost can't afford to have them sustainably go down. That's a separate debate. But I think there is still the scope to things getting bumpy, and I just sense that sort of stock market fear that was all pervasive 2 months ago has not entirely gone, but there seems to be a little bit more confidence out there. And again, as you've correctly said, given the background, I wouldn't want to be too confident about much right now. So call me boring, but you know, the first, you know, it's the old Buffett thing. Rule number one is don't lose money. And although that's not easy, I think I wouldn't personally be looking to go looking for risk and therefore potentially trouble right now. I think there may be more propitious entry point, shall we say. I hope I'm wrong, but it's just the way it feels to me.
No, I absolutely agree. I mean, you know, it's a time where I think we've got some more volatility. I said recently, and someone said, "What do you mean?" I said, I think people have to be a bit more bullish before we have the big sell-off. Because at the moment, when that fear kicked in and everyone sold, everyone was dashing for cash. Mm. Everyone who wanted to sell was sold, so the sellers had sold. And now all you're getting is people fear of missing out. Get people buying in, not everyone buying in as yet. Not everyone's convinced yet by this rally. No. When people are convinced by the rally, that's when we get the big sell off, you know, when everyone's in.
That's the way it works.
And you can only get out, you know. So, yeah. All right. Marvellous, Russ, well, have a nice weekend. And
you enjoy the long weekend.
Yeah. Are you edging out a bit more now at the moment or not?
The lads playing a bit more cricket up at the Nets, but that's about as far as we've gone. We thought we might go for a drive up to the Sussex Downs over the weekend because there's lots of space up there when all's said and done. So that will help a little bit, but other than that, I don't think we'll be straying too far. But I think we are starting to think of spreading our wings a little bit further within the narrow confines of the regions of Brighton rather than just the park nearby. I think. Yes. What about you?
Yeah. No. Well, we're sticking around, but we've got a decent sized garden. But it's also this thing again. Another fear could be the second wave. You know, Trump said he's not a lockdown for the second wave. That could happen if we unlock too quickly. And that, again, that's an unforeseen thing that could happen, isn't it? You know. So,
correct.
So play it safe. We're staying in. We got a garden here and a trampoline. We got all we want: balls, footballs. So we got all we want in there.
Perfect.
Marvellous. Cheers, Russ.
Take care.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Hill, equity analyst and full-time private investor. You're right, Paul.
Yeah, morning, Justin. That was a very good introduction. In fact, it was a bit better than the mic take you did last week. That's about my super large headphones.
Yeah. listen, I had just had a chat with Russ Mould, who's from AJ Bell. He's an investment director, and we're talking about the amount companies issuing equity, raising funds. And I said, listen, and I thought, you know what, private investors should take note of this. And I keep saying the financial fallout hasn't happened. You know, Q2 is the worst. Of course, we know it's the worst, so some of it may be priced in. But I said to him, I think it's going to be so overwhelming, the amount of companies bad reporting, after a while, the stock market will start to roll over. And, you know, we've had a bounce. And yet now companies are issuing equity to batten down the hatches. And I think that's almost a signpost for private investors to do the same. You know, if you can get a bit of cash on board now and see what happens in, you know, with the Q2 results, it's a good thing because that's what companies are doing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I think you've actually, you know, sort of like called it early because that's certainly what I've been noticing over the last week or so. Good companies that have actually issued some solid or decent results. I mean, take Aviva yesterday. Mm-hmm. They came up with a sort of better than expected solvency ratio and net asset figures that, you know, look reasonable to me. And the shares went down. And what's actually seems to be happening, from my, you know, take on it, is that, you know, basically because companies are actually issuing a lot of equity, things like Compass and we've had Whitbread as well, you know, £1 billion, etc., then that's actually sucking a bit of capital out the secondary markets because the institutions are actually saving some dry powder for the primary markets when companies come back to it and want to raise more equity. So I'm with you. I think we're going to be in this limbo stage. The sentiment at top level in the macro side has actually just turned from being pretty much positive to sort of fairly negative. And until we get some positive macro data or particularly medical data, maybe Remdesivir or some sort of vaccine coming through, I think we're going to be staying in this sort of like slight bias at the top level towards the negative side. I mean, you look at sort of the house builders 2 weeks ago when they started actually opening up their sites, they rocketed and they were really strong, and now they've actually come off quite a lot. And again, look at the old Bovis Homes business, now called Vistry. It came out that actually it had opened up, I think it was 85% of its sites this week, which is absolutely terrific. And it said that it was, you know, trading pretty well. It was selling quite a few houses already at prices that were in line with expectations. And on that basis, you know, you'd have expected the shares to go up. They've actually gone down. And you look at it and you just think, this is crazy. And the reason is, as I'm sure, you know, you've hit the nail on the head, is it such that, you know, institutional investors are saving some capital or even selling some capital ahead of new or current ongoing equity raises. It's just sucking a bit of capital out of the market, so it just needs to be digested. But don't be surprised for private investors if your company comes out with some pretty damn good results and you look at it and actually it's a ho-hum response by the market. Don't be disappointed. That's just, it's just normal sort of rebalancing of the whole sort of, you know, market.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I just think we've had that relief rally, haven't we, really? You know, where we've gone from, you know, a big fall-off in March, and now we had a big bounce, largely led by NASDAQ. And now I think we're going to have the realism of the financial fallout coming soon, you know, because NASDAQ, I've got to keep saying this to myself, stop looking at the indices so much, because I'm a stock picker. I don't play the indices. I don't spread bet. They don't mean a lot to me. I mean, they're good to look at now and again, but getting fixated with them is false, really, because the NASDAQ is, and S&P, you know, if you look at, I think it was run about, even Rush just said it, actually, about eight, including Microsoft, the FANG stocks, hold about sort of, run about, just around about 18% of S&P 500. Which is nuts. And so, of course, it's skewed towards their performance rather than the rest. You're better off looking at the Russell, is it 3,000 or Russell 2,000, I think, yeah. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think you can, you know, if you're a stock picker, then look at actual particular companies. I would say, though, you know, what's actually juiced the market, as you rightly say, it's central bank intervention. I mean, I, first of all, at the start of the year, called the COVID-19 disaster wrong at the start. I thought it was just basically a mere 3-month thing. And then I also, when it transpired that it was actually much worse, then called or underestimated the amount of central bank intervention. And they're still very, very supportive. I mean, you just heard, you know, Jerome Powell last week saying, we will do whatever it takes, and we've got plenty of more bullets left to fire. So, you know, I think the market is, all it's doing is just digesting some information, just taking a sort of pause for breath to, you know, to move higher. And if we get medical, solid medical data, which comes through from Remdesivir or some sort of vaccine which comes through, good positive, it's going to fly up again. And it's just really that, you know, companies are now coming back to the sort of, you know, the table asking for more money, that's actually taking some of the juice, some of the shine off the market. I mean, let's be clear about it. Have the house builders, you know, decreased in value over the last sort of like couple of weeks, even though the shares have dropped sort of 5 or 10%? The answer is clearly not. I mean, if anything, they've actually gone up because the sites, you know, they're opening up more sites, they're getting more used to the actual social distancing, and they weren't overvalued, you know, sort of 2 weeks ago. Absolutely no way. So, you know, this is just really sentiment driven. And if you've enjoyed the sort of the jump as a private investor, and you want to sort of like keep a bit of cash, you know, or raise a bit of cash for future opportunities, particularly if you think your stocks need to raise more money. I mean, for instance, this morning we had Accesso, the theme park software business, which has actually seen a major bounce. It raised, I think it was 32-33 million pounds, which is about 40% of its market cap, at £2.90. So if you think that your company needs to raise money, that being one, then yes, you need to have a bit of spare capital to be able to participate without getting diluted. And that's how some of the professional investors are actually playing it. But as I keep coming back, you know, you look at price versus value. Price is what changes every single day. Value doesn't always change. In fact, can go up. As I say, you know, you've got Aviva yesterday, put out some good results. My view, the underlying inherent worth, the value of that business went up because it was a better solid balance sheet. It taken really a very modest, had to take a very modest provision when it came to COVID-19. It was about a net 160 million, which is absolutely, you know, nothing compared to a 9 billion pound market cap. And the shares just went up a bit, but actually they, by their close of play, went down, and then went down again today. But the value's gone up, the price has decreased. And if you look at the actual balance between the two, the shares are trading at a 25%, you know, discount to what I class as net tangible assets. So, you know, you've got, the thing is, a lot of people get confused between price and value, and they get sucked into this whole thing that if the price is moving rapidly, then, you know, it's something worth, this is a problem. But it actually could be the value is going, you know, the opposite direction. So it's value which should drive, you know, your decisions.
Have you been looking, is it just a worry? I think it's certain signs, isn't it, that we're coming out. I mean, I know, you know, Fed, I think they spent 102 billion last week, the Fed, which is down from 212 the week before, but still a big chunk, you know, in the market they're buying. But is this talk about negative interest rates, is that affecting them in any way? And just
it's affecting sentiment, no doubt about it. I mean, you look at the actual banks this week. I think the Treasury issued 3-year gilt, which actually was bid down to the first time less than zero. Mm. I mean, it was it was like 0.003%, I think it hit as a yield, so negative 0.003. And on that basis, yes, that is actually not been very helpful for sentiment, and certainly on the banks, and that's why you've seen all the banks get pretty much continually crushed. I mean, again, you look at the AGM statement by Lloyds yesterday. They didn't release any bad news. If anything, they were saying, well, they're pretty much comfortable. They've got a solid balance sheet. You know, they've looked through it all. They can't see any. I mean, there are risks, clearly, but they're not exposed to all the sort of the hot spots and the real sort of the epicenter of the, you know, the retail or oil and gas or airlines or anything like that. And when all they're largely exposed to is the mortgage book and if house prices, you know, are staying solid. I mean, that was backed up. And just again, you know, it's nuts, really. But you look at house prices, everybody's baking in. And I did originally, you know, house prices to decrease this year. And yes, they have probably decreased over the last 2 or 3 months, but they're going up. I mean, that's what, you know, Bovis said. They said basically when it comes to house prices, they're right in line with our expectations. And we haven't seen a noticeable fall off, you know, on buyers. And in fact, if anything, we're getting increasing people through the door. So, you know, I would say, yes, negative interest rates is not helpful. But if you believe...
But is that good for house builders, though? Negative interest rates or not?
Well, yes. I mean, they actually borrow at reasonable, you know, a lot on the balance sheet.
But also mortgages. If we go to negative interest rates, right? Apparently, some people are saying now we're not going to do it. Bank of England, even though they've mentioned it, and so he said he wouldn't take it off the table, the governor, as an option. But it's such a thing, isn't it? I was reading in the Guardian about its bank in I don't know where it was it Denmark somewhere? I don't know. But they were saying that you could put a negative interest rate, mortgage rate, you know, so people could actually borrow money, be paid to borrow money. That would be good for house builders.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah, you know, yeah. It probably would be, right. Yeah, absolutely for house builders. It's not less good for the banks, and that's why they've sort of gone down. But the banks are actually trading at sort of, I mean, Lloyds, for instance, now is trading at around about half of what its net tangible assets is, which is absolutely nuts. I mean, that's just so much better. Bad news already priced in, but yeah, it should be good. I mean, if you put, you know, negative interest rates would be good for a lot of parts of the actual economy, but overall it isn't that great. And you look at what's actually happened to Europe and to Japan in terms of growth. Any country that's been sort of locked into negative interest rates has just not generated any major, you know, increase in GDP. I mean, look at Italy, you know, all these kind of, it's not great for long-term growth. I actually think what will happen anyway is such that given all of central bank stimulus, we'll see a pickup in inflation in CPI at some point in time, certainly on asset price inflation. And on that basis, even though the central banks can nail the front end of the yield curve down to sort of like, you know, if they want to go negative, they can go negative, but they can't control the long end of it, the 10-year, the 15-year, the 30-year even. And on that, you'll start seeing a steepening of that yield curve, which will be good for, you know, the lenders, like, you know, on the bank side. So I actually think inflation is won't go rampant, but I actually think it will. You know, we're going to see increases at some point. Certainly, probably not in the next 12 months, but I wouldn't discount it in the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. Do you know what I'm looking at? I keep thinking now, we don't know how long this is going to go on for, and even the open is a gradual lifting of the lockdown. So, you know, how fast the demand comes back, even the supply is there, is questionable. So I'm thinking, okay. And I've been thinking for a while, what companies will benefit not only during this lockdown, but will they've been doing quite well, and there's a trend change happening that will see them doing even better. And that's what I'm looking at the moment. And that's why, a while back, I bought invested in Manolet Partners, you know, Mano, in a litigation business, you know, and also Tristel. And I thought those two companies there, they were doing well anyway. They were growing at, you know, 20% per year, pretty much, on revenue, on top line and bottom line. And yet this has added into that mix, which will, I think, you know, mean it'll be, you know, increase their business completely. So I'm just looking at companies like that. I think, okay, you need a couple of companies that you think will benefit from this, and it'll be a long-term change, or enhance that change, or the trend has been there, but it's been accelerated, you know, and that's what this thing is doing now. So have you ever looked at any of those litigation businesses? Because I think a lot of businesses are going to go through, aren't they? And they're going to have problems with that in the next few months.
Yeah, I'm less keen on litigation businesses because they hold lots and lots of working capital, because effectively a lot of them are on a no fee, no win basis. Yeah. And you don't really know whether they're going to be able to collect it. And you get things like Burford Capital who's come up, and you've had a few of the like Quindell and stuff. You can't trust the balance sheet, so I tend to steer away clear. I think the bigger point you're raising, though, is what happens to the consumer once we start lifting lockdowns. And to be perfectly honest, a lot of people, sensible guys, are actually saying, well, it's going to take a bit of time, blah, blah, blah. But didn't we just have a major test on Wednesday? Yeah. When the sun came out, how many people went down the beach?
Yeah. No, and like I said, we humans are amazing. We've got this ability to adapt. That's why one of the most efficient creatures on the planet. We are the leaders pretty much, and we adapt very quickly. And sentiment can change very quickly. Like I said, we know that being in the stock market, we can see one day a big sell off and the world is imploding. You know, the heavens are falling in financially. Next day, a big rally, and all of a sudden it's flipped. It's gone from fear to fear of missing out, and people start buying again. So I think once, if we get some figures coming out saying, listen, the R rate now has been down below zero for a long time. There's very little chance of infection, you know, if you're doing this and this. And even if you're below the age of 60, anyway, and healthy, it's not much going to happen to you anyway. I think once that happens, I think honestly, the sentiment will change very quickly. I'm not saying we'll go back to 100% of where we were 2019, but I don't think it'll take a long time to get back to a near normal, you know. So,
we had a flipping test on Wednesday.
Yeah.
Everybody descended on Saunton Beach in Devon. I mean, you saw those pictures. It was just absolutely incredible.
The only difference is, though, I mean, I think, you know, going to the beach that can be quite cheap, you know, and even if you lost your job, you can pretty much go to the beach or if your job's in question. But I think what we've got to look at, and I think this is the key point, is of these people being laid off, in America now it's a quarter of the workforce, initial jobless claims. That's a gross figure we know, so we don't know what the net is really. Or in fact, it's 25 million continued claims, but that'll come down. I think it all depends on how many people will go back to work and how fast, you know? And that's it. That because once you've got a job, you're happy spending pretty much. You've got a bit of security there. If you haven't got a job, you're not going to go out spending. Full stop. So I need to tighten your belt, and everyone starts tightening their belt. So I just think, how fast will we get back to, you know, I mean, because if you look at the financial crash, it took 10 years to build up to 22 million. And now we've just lost that in America in over a month. So
You just got to remember, though, this is not a standard recession, yeah? And all I'd say is that you've had, you know, the whole billions of people around the world have been locked down. So what you could probably likely to get is you get like a rage type opening. Lots of people who have just had been so, you know, frustrated and wanted to get out, they're going to get out, yeah? So as soon as we open the door, then they're going to go to the beach, they're going to go to the park, they're probably going to start spending as well. Then the reality of the economic situation will probably kick in. So probably that half of those guys will then sort of like rein in some of their expenditure after having that initial blast. Yeah, it's a bit like Christmas come again, yeah? So you're going to see a bit of a peak, and then you're going to see a bit of a slowdown, you know, which will actually, you know, sort of drive the economy. But I do think, you know, if you look sort of through the trend, I mean, if you've got 36 million people in the US, yeah, who need to get back into the workforce, I think about, you know, probably about half of them will get back over the next sort of like, you know, 1 to 2 years. And for companies, I mean, one of the companies I invested in, ClearStar, that would be a perfect for them because they do the sort of the background screening of that. But again, coming back to the sort of the big picture wise, I know when we first chatted, I said, what is the most, you know, sort of important letter in the alphabet R, and what is the most important number one? Now, one actually is, I've realized, actually is not the most important number. It's actually 1.7. And 1.7 is when we start lifting social distancing, which is what we're doing now. Now, my view, having run the calculations, just taking the UK, yeah, is that you then have to layer in how much immunity the population gets by running, you know, sort of like lifting the you know, the lockdown. Let's just, for argument's sake, because most medical experts seem to be nodding at this, it's like we get 15% immunity by the beginning of September, when the next infection wave could arrive, yeah? Mm. Now, if we stay below 1.7 through social distancing, track and trace, then yes, we're going to get a number, let's say for argument's sake, another 10 million people in the UK who get infected, i.e. another 15%. 1% get hospitalized. hospitalised because we've got better ways of actually treating them through like Remdesivir and things like that, half of which then get sort of like, you know, fatalities. That means we get another 50,000 people deaths, yeah, which I think is the limit of our, you know, sort of being able to stomach it politically. But the important bit is the 1.7, yeah, which is, you know, gives us a fair sort of like wiggle room. It also reduces the herd immunity level from 60% down to 40%, which means a third wave then doesn't exist because we're already at 30%. So when we come back to this big picture, when even if we haven't got a vaccine, is it safe to get back into the market? Well, my view is that it will be, because we won't go, I don't think we're going to go above 1.7 on the R, which will then allow the economy to start kicking in. And those people, you know, those companies that benefit from, you know, a release will actually do okay. I wouldn't go anywhere near, I still wouldn't go close to the airlines and these sort of like areas that will be slow. But, you know, I can actually see the economy getting back on its feet, 85 to, you know, percent of the, you know, the economy quite quickly, because I think that you're going to get this rage type opening. I mean, as I say, if we're allowed to go on holidays in July, staycations, I mean, that's got to help the dining sectors and the, I think a lot of people will do it.
Mm-hmm. So what are you waiting for then? Why are you piling in now?
Well, I've actually been nibbling this week. I mean, I added to one of my stocks, which was Northbridge, which is going to, I mean, as all these industrial sites and construction sites and renewable energy and all this sort of stuff open up, which has been one of the limiters on their Crestchick business, which is load banks, then they now can go back into it, in my view. I don't know, but I'm pretty sure they'll almost be able to access those sites on a social distancing world. And that's their biggest division. It sort of makes 80% of their EBITDA. And with the recovery, as we've talked about in the oil price, from, you know, sort of like going from super contango down to backwardization, I actually think it's largely, when they say oil and gas Tasman division, which is much smaller out in Australia, it's actually 80% gas, and gas has done reasonable. So I actually think they're going to do okay. So and the shares are only about 85p. They're pretty much illiquid. So, you know, if you're interested in that share, then it's quite difficult to buy them. But that's what I've sort of, you know, topped up. I'm still holding the Lloyds because I think that's, I actually think we're going to be fine. I mean, okay, there are dangers, but the balance sheet looks fine to me. Aviva, when I say the results yesterday, I thought they were reasonably positive. The shares went up, now they've come down, and I've got no problem with that. I'm just going to hold for the long term. ClearStar, which I owned, I mean, they came out with the first American, this is an example of sort of like sentiment, they came out with the first workplace COVID-19 test service, that service launch across the whole nationwide. The shares went up and now they've come down. And you look at it and you just think, that is a game changer when it comes to valuation, or potential game changer. But because investors are sort of like, you know, looking at it as a glass half empty, then, you know, people are sort of like, you know, not buying the shares, which is absolutely fine. I've got no problem with that because, you know, the price can do what it likes, but the long-term, you know, future should be fine. And as I say, with the added juice of potentially 18 million Americans going back into the, you know, the workforce, you know, the ClearStar, which does background screening tests and medical testing out in the US, it's 99% of its sales, should benefit hugely, you know, on the back of that. And then the third, you know, the fifth stock I own, which is, you know, Alicosoft, and we talked about it, Buildtech, they're doing absolutely fine again. You know, the construction industry is opening up. It provides the software, the clever visualization, the design software, and the project planning for that. And, you know, they didn't see much of a downturn anyway. And I suspect, oh, you know, if anything, we're going to see, you know, more investment going forward. So I'm very happy with where I am, actually, even though the prices are pretty, you know, in the doghouse, you know, in terms of I've lost quite a bit of money. But frankly, I'm of a long term, you know, investor, two to 5 year sort of time horizon. So I can wait it out. And I always say to investors is such that, you know, don't get freaked out by price movements, concentrate on the value. And if you believe in the actual story, then stick with it. I've still got quite a lot of cash, probably like yourself, looking to deploy, but I actually don't find there are masses and masses of really good opportunities, you know, to buy. So, you know, I'm just, again, I'm sort of being patient, but if I saw the right opportunity, yeah, I'd put some more money in.
Yeah. No, I think that it's down to the price, isn't it? Let's be honest. You know, there's companies out there that are going to be good next 3 to 5 years. And it's just the moment we've had a bounce. I think that now is not the time to buy. We need it to come down again. I think we need that, you know, constant, almost like a machine gun effect of company after company releasing really bad news from the Q2, and then that'll drag the market down a bit, and then we can see, you know, the valuations and their forward guidance, maybe because they partly be opened by then. So some, you know, some of these companies in July, when they start releasing Q2 figures, they'll partly sort of be opened, and so they'll have a bit more clarity, you know, a bit more forward guidance, maybe, and maybe we can sort of see how the ground lays. But until, you know, no rush at the moment, I don't think, no rush.
Yeah,
at all.
And also I'd bake in a healthy margin of safety when you come to actually, you know, buy shares. If you think a share was worth a pound, you know, look to buy it at 75p or less. You know, give yourself that level of safety, mm-hmm. You know, for protection going forward. Just makes a lot of sense to me. And I would also say is that, you know, the cost of equity in terms of, you know, sort of raising money, it absolutely mooned, it ballooned out, you know, during the sort of the epicenter of the sort of 23rd of March 2 months ago, but it still is relatively high. So, you know, lift your expectations on future returns given the risk. Don't sort of like accept low return shares just because you want to get, you know, exposure, unless you absolutely have to. You know, look for good or excellent returns going forward and be patient, because they will arrive. You know, you will get those opportunities. It's just as a matter of keeping your eyes and ears open.
Yeah, lovely. Keep your ears, eyes open, even if you've got a big set of headphones attached to them. Keep them wide open. That's fine. Paul, thanks for that. I'll speak next week.
Yeah, thank you. Bye.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. It's Mobile Streams, 1.4% down at 0.35 pence. At four, Omega Diagnostics, down 1% to 52.5. Avacta is at three. At three, Avacta. It's at up 5%, pretty much, or 4.5% to 191.5. At two, Tiziana Life Sciences. It's just dipped to 99 pence, up 16%. And at one, Tissue Regenics. Did a fundraise, of course. Discounted, I think. So that's down 48% to 0.5 pence. All right. Top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, these are most liked and most read, by the way. Coro Energy, Diang, PSC, Acquisition Completion Indonesia, Open Orphan, results of fundraising. At three, Tiziana Life Sciences, Holdings and Company. At two, investment in Trident Resources. That's Metal Tiger. Never put the name on an RNS. It's quite annoying. And at one, Regal Petroleum, SV54 well results. And that's up, well, it's been quite well read and quite well liked. It's up 0.51%. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Buying a car in Carvana was so easy. I was able to finance it through them.
Whoa, wait, you mean finance?
Yeah, finance. Got pre-qualified for a Carvana auto loan, entered my terms, and shopped from thousands of great car options all within my budget.
That's cool that financing through Carvana was so easy.
Financed. Done. And I get to pick up my car from their Carvana vending machine tomorrow.
Financed.
Right, that's what I said.
You can spend time trying to pronounce financing, or you can actually finance and buy your car today on
Carvana.
Financing subject to credit approval. Additional terms and conditions may apply.